numbers. Humidity is 65%. Little breeze from the south at 5. Still a bit of a cloud cover, but it's breaking up. 64 degrees for Kenosha and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later in the hour, in part two of today's program, I'm going to be replaying from the archives a memorable conversation I recorded more than a decade ago with a woman who was in the World Trade Center on 9/11. And in fact, she was the last survivor to be pulled alive from the rubble of Ground Zero. And wrote a memoir called Angel in the Rubble. And we'll be replaying that in part two of today's program. In part one of today's program, we are talking about poetry, the beauty of poetry, the way in which it can make such a difference in our own lives and in the life of our community collectively. And we're specifically going to be talking about the Poet Laureate program in both Kenosha and Racine. Joining us today, Jean Preston and Jennifer Kozolou, who are both on the committee of the Kenosha Racine Poet Laureate Program. And both Kenosha and Racine are in search of new Poets Laureate. And we're going to be talking about the program and about what it means to have that title of Poet Laureate. And some of the really exciting and moving things that have been created. And we'll talk about the search that is currently underway and maybe give some of you listening maybe an idea about pursuing this exciting possibility. Jean Preston, Jennifer Kozolou, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you for having us.
Good to have both of you here. I should mention that Jennifer was supposed to join us, was it a week or two ago?
A week ago today.
Yeah, and was feeling poorly that morning and was not able to be with us. So a few days later, you are here, but you mentioned you were at home in bed listening to the interview go on without you, and you gave it your stamp of approval.
Absolutely. It was a wonderful one.
Very good. Well, let's get to the matter at hand, which is this whole notion of the Poet Laureate, and talk for a moment, first of all, about the search for new Poets Laureate, for both Kenosha and Racine, and the fact that it is happening in a slightly different time frame than was originally planned. So let's have one of you explain kind of the sad reason why this is having to be done just a little bit differently or at a different point in the calendar.
Sure. Several months ago now, unfortunately, our Racine Poet Laureate, Betty, passed away unexpectedly. And we're just heartbroken. It is an incredible loss to our committee, to our poetry community. And so we just wanted to take some space and honor her.
She was really a... just a lovely woman, smart mm-hmm. and accomplished and kind.
So compassionate.
And had a unique, each poet laureate has a project, and her project, the main focus was to bring poetry into book clubs, which book clubs typically don't address poetry as a rule. Mm-hmm. And she was very passionate about that. She did many readings. And she was also from the county, which we really have struggled to reach out into the counties. Mm-hmm. And so we were very happy that she was our Poet Laureate for Racine, and really sad that we've lost her.
Right. So how long was she Racine Poet Laureate?
Well, each term is 2 years. So she was about a year and a half in.
And so it sounds like it just did not feel right to immediately engage in a search for the next poet laureate. Mm-hmm. As you said, I think very nicely, it you needed emotional space and time to, in a sense, honor her legacy.
For sure.
Right. But now the search goes on. Mm-hmm. And so for a poet laureate for Kenosha and for Racine. So first of all, let's get a little historical background on how long there's even been this thing called the Poet Laureate here in southeastern Wisconsin, and especially how long it's been kind of a joint effort with Kenosha and Racine.
We're approaching 15 years, aren't we?
14 for sure.
Yeah.
I think it's always been a joint. That was the whole idea, was to bring the communities together. And so from the onset, we've had a Poet Laureate from Racine and one from Kenosha. The COVID years were a little bit of a challenge. We actually extended those Poets Laureates' terms for a year because they really lost a year of being able to be out in the community and do readings and projects. So we extended theirs for a year. So, it's a long-standing program, and we're very proud of it.
As someone who lives in Racine but works in Kenosha, and having had a lot of involvement, for instance, in the two symphonies, for instance, in the two community bands, I mean, to me, it makes perfect sense, you know, for the two cities to work together and cooperate. But especially when I moved to the area back in 1986, that was really uncommon. I mean, and one of the nicest things to see over the last several decades is sort of a thawing of some of the iciness that I think really existed between Kenosha and Racine. But nevertheless, we still don't see all that many joint efforts like this with Poet Laureate. So I applaud whoever made the decision to pursue it in this way. So explain what it means when somebody is a Poet Laureate, when they are so designated. What kind of responsibilities are we talking about? Or is it more of an honor that they are receiving?
I think it's both. Poets Laureate are charged with the responsibility of bringing poetry into the community and encouraging people to read and write and enjoy poetry. And in our program, each Poet Laureate is encouraged and expected to do some kind of a project in the community. We've had a wide variety of projects. Betty with her book clubs, Nick Ramsey in prisons and with schools, doing writing. When I was Poet Laureate, I did a project where I got poems from seniors in high school, seniors in college, and senior citizens. It was called Senior Voices. And they wrote letters in poetry form to the city of Kenosha. What else?
And mental health together. And of course, we have our current Kenosha laureate did a project tying poetry to Lake Michigan.
And his project was huge.
Yes.
I mean, he really,
he's very
really
ambitious.
Worked hard and put together a beautiful chapbook and all these poems all over the city. In stores, you'll see them posted. And he had a big reading at Blue House Books. Where he invited the authors of the poems to come and read. So, I mean, it was quite an extensive program. He did a super job.
So it sounds like for each poet laureate, they are given, if not quite free rein, I mean, really given the opportunity to create a project that feels right to them and
yes.
maybe
mm-hmm.
folds into who they are and mm-hmm. their particular gifts.
Yeah, poetry is so personal, and we want the project to reflect that, but also it's their legacy as a laureate, you know, and you want that to be something that can live in your heart.
Sure, and unique to each one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious how wide a range of people have enjoyed this distinction of being a poet laureate in Kenosha or Racine, in terms of, I mean, how balanced has it been in terms of gender? How balanced has it been in terms of ages mm-hmm. or maybe socioeconomic background, that kind of thing? Mm-hmm. I mean, have they been all over the map?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so. We've definitely had wide ranges of ages, backgrounds. We've never run the numbers, but just thinking back, I think gender is pretty split.
Equalized, yeah.
All kinds of different kinds of diversity throughout.
Very good. Glad to hear it. So you brought with you a copy of this book that was part of the project of the most recent Kenosha Poet Laureate.
Mm-hmm.
Remind us about his name and a little bit about his background, and then we'll maybe hear a little bit from this collection.
Yeah, Christopher Colon. He came to us from, I want to say, Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm.
He was a transplant to Kenosha who we met at we had done an event at the Kenosha Public Library for Poetry Month where we had just groups of people come together and read poetry and enjoy. And some of it was work that people had written and some of it was work that people loved or were experiencing for the first time even. And Chris showed up to that and was just immediately engaged with the program. And
we with him. He read
yeah.
a poem and we were all like, where have you been?
Yeah, we encouraged him to apply. And then when the time came up, we always do blind readings of the poems to kind of narrow down the initial rounds. And his poems, along with Betty's, of course, were standout among the applications.
He's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when it comes to making the decision then about this person will be a poet laureate,
mm-hmm.
does it come down to simply, I mean, not that it's a simple matter, but to simply whose poetry you think is the finest, or is it a little bit bigger decision than that?
Well, poetry is so personal, and so individuals' poetry can be very good for very different reasons and have very different feelings to them. So that's certainly a part of it, is the quality of work. But we also, you know, interview and connect with them. You know, we're interested in their reading. We're interested in they present their projects to us as part of the application process. So we try to really kind of look at the whole package and see who is going to bring both quality work and then a quality presence into the position.
Right. Because I suppose it would be theoretically possible for somebody to be a wonderful poet in isolation, mm-hmm. but they maybe would not possess the mm-hmm. gifts or the skills to share that gift with the community or to advocate
and
for the importance of poetry.
And we have had applicants whose work is quite strong, but they... You know, in reflection, maybe not quite ready to be out in the community and be doing public readings. And, you know, we encourage those people to start engaging in those sorts of things and apply again. It's not like, you know, you're one strike and you're out. Mm-hmm. It's like, we really loved your work, or we thought this was really strong. But, you know, next time around, maybe work on this. And the project, too, I wanted to say, you know, they do present a project to us, but that really can morph over time, because you come in with a set idea and you realize, you know, I want to move, and you're not restricted.
Sure.
You know, there's lots of room for revision.
Sure. And I suppose sometimes life happens and world events happen. And I mean, something like COVID happens, or the war in Ukraine or what. I mean, one can imagine a lot of circumstances under which what the community might be needing in that moment might be different from what you felt just a few months earlier. Right. Interesting. So back to the book that I mentioned that that you both have with you. So explain a little more about how this book took shape, about the nature of Chris's project.
So he just put out a call, many calls, for people to participate in many venues and many ways. He solicited poetry about Lake Michigan. He was so drawn to the lake when he came here, maybe from Albuquerque, that's understandable. And he ended up titling it The Lake is Mother to Us All. That was the name of his project, the name of his book. And he got a huge response and whittled it down to this chapbook and the poems that are posted. And he just did a marvelous job.
And is this book still available for purchase?
Yes.
Yes. It will not be after October, I want to say, but it currently is available for purchase. I want to say at Modern Apothecary. I think Blue House Books still has some copies, and possibly some other locations downtown, but those two come to mind right away. And then we do have two copies at the Kenosha Public Library as well, if people want to check them out and experience the poetry that way.
Right. So does someone want to read something that they especially like from this collection?
Well, I think I'd like to read Betty's poem, just to honor her. Her poem is in here. And what I liked about her, she has such a sense of humor. And, you know, it would kind of sneak up on you. So this is called The Polar Bear Plunge by Elizabeth Park. Because I had a significant birthday, I decide it is finally time to do it, to plunge into the lake on New Year's. I shed my outer clothes on the cold shore, run into the lake, dive under floating ice. The icy water stuns and numbs me, makes me gasp, knocks me breathless, paralyzed. I watch the shivering crowd leave till I am alone in the sluggish surf. Move, I tell my halted heart and stiff legs. When at last I stagger out to the frozen beach, I am proud, nearsighted, bewildered polar bear whose jacket, towel, and glasses are gone.
Oh, that is good. Oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Well, and it's funny, when I'm imagining a collection of poems about Lake Michigan, never in a million years would I imagine that would be part of it. I mean, and why not? I mean, it's part of the story of the lake and something that people have experienced, but a lot of us have never experienced, never will, and it's one way for us to kind of get a taste of that. Yeah. Oh, what a great choice. And yes, the much missed Elizabeth Park.
Yeah.
Jennifer, you have one too?
Yeah, I have Chris's poem here titled The Lake is Mother to Us All. Let's see here.
So this is like the title track of the album, in a sense.
Pretty much, yep. Sure. I climb across the boulders that lined the lakeside of Southport Park, settling down on a thick ledge that juts out over the water. Waves gurgle underneath me as they sluice through stone, counterpoint to the sound of the bamboo flute I am preparing to play. Who else is greeting you, Mother Lake, on this sunny, windy day? Two men parked in a Kenosha City pickup truck, eating sandwiches, drinking coffee, eyes scanning the endless blue. Glassers on Simmons Beach, boaters at the marina. Walkers and cyclists, drunks and addicts. Lonely people on benches, and lovers walking hand in hand in Wolfenbüttel Park. Tourists and teachers, school kids and shop workers, and others whose lives are enriched by the constancy of these waters. Lake Michigan presents herself equally to every one of her children. And though there are times she berates us with winter storms or summer squalls, her power is just a reflection of our limitations, a lesson that humbles as it teaches. This mother lake, whose waters are so full of promise and solace, provides connection to something bigger than ourselves, a mystery and a gift available to all who share her shoreline. I offer my flute to the lake and begin to play, not really sure why I am playing. The lake doesn't care. She listens.
Ah, wonderful. And it's such a great sort of overarching look at the lake and all that it means to such a wide array of people. Yeah, yeah. A beautiful celebration. Mm-hmm. What a really great idea. What's the title of this collection again?
The Lake is Mother to Us All, Poems Celebrating Lake Michigan.
Very good. And as Jennifer indicated, it is still for sale at a couple of different places in Kenosha, and you can also find a copy at the Kenosha Public Library if you want to explore it further. For those of you just joining us, we're talking poetry today and the Poet Laureate program for both Kenosha and Racine with Jennifer Kozaloo and Jean Preston, who are both on the committee, and they are in search of new Poets Laureate for Kenosha and Racine, and that determination you intend to make by the middle of October. I thought it would be interesting for us to spend a little time talking with each of you about the place that poetry has had in your own lives and the work that you yourself have done as poets. So I'm wondering, Jean, let's begin with you. Can you remember when it was that poetry kind of first entered your life? When was that?
Well, I remember as a child being intrigued by poetry and writing those little kid poems, and then I kind of put that away. But when I went back to school at Carthage, I was a returning student, as we were called. I went back to school later in life. And my first English class was creative writing with Dan Tobin, a wonderful poet. And about 5 minutes into the first class, I was hooked.
Five whole minutes.
So from that point, I majored in English and concentrated in creative writing, and then got an MFA at the University of Southern Maine, Stone Coast Writing Program, which allowed me to come back to Carthage and teach. And so I taught at night to start, and then began teaching through the English department, and was able to teach creative writing, not as much as I would have liked, but often enough. And then got involved with the Poet Laureate program. And to me, it's just a way to reach people in a different way, let people share their voices in a different way. I love teaching workshops where people who say, I can't write poetry, write poems.
Now, when you first got excited in Professor Tobin's course, were you excited by, oh, my word, poetry is so wonderful, or were you excited by the notion of writing poetry yourself, or did that come a little bit later?
I think both. Dan was extremely demanding as far as reading and doing critical work, so reading a lot of, you know, poets and writing about their work and essays that poets had written, books that poets had written, but at the same time, in tandem, we were writing our own work. And realizing that I could do that, certainly not like some of those famous poets, but that I could do that and do it well was exciting. So both sides of that coin.
Very good. Jennifer, how about you? When do you remember being first bitten by the poetry bug?
I wasn't a huge fan of poetry when I was younger, to be honest. I started engaging with poetry through my love of music. I studied voice in undergrad and music history in grad school. And so for me, engaging with poetry as a piece of music was something that was really special. And the way that words and music together could kind of lift one another up.
I just have to ask, give us one or two examples of like a really special song where you feel like, you know, that you had felt a really powerful connection to the text.
Oh, gosh.
And are we talking about mostly like songs in English, or even when you would sing a song in German or Italian?
Yeah.
Would you feel that too?
I really loved singing in other languages because I think that one of the special things about text is the way the sounds, the individual sounds, come together to create meaning.
Mm.
And that is something that I think is very special about poetry. And of course, now you ask me, and the only pieces of music I can think of are ones that don't have text to them, which I love as well.
Right.
But I always really loved, like, German art song especially was a standout for me. And I particularly loved singing in Spanish as well.
Huh.
I think both of those languages, the way that the sound comes together, and then the meaning behind the text was always just really passionate.
Yeah.
I think they're both very passionate languages, although people maybe don't think that as much about German.
Huh.
But I always found it to be. So, yeah, that was kind of my introduction and breaking down of poetry through my understanding of music. And then eventually I became a librarian. And when I came to Kenosha, I was asked to join the Poet Laureate as a representative from the library, and my understanding and appreciation deepened through working with poets and reading more poetry. And I think for me personally, I found a lot of satisfaction and enjoyment in hearing poetry and reading poetry that is connected to this place in which we live.
Hmm.
I think it's there aren't enough local poets lifted up in the world. You know, we have this almost canon of poetry, but I think it is so much more personal and meaningful when the poems are written by the people in your community and inspired by your community. And so for me, that just brought a richness and a depth to poetry that I hadn't previously experienced.
Very good. So have you engaged in the writing of poetry, or are you more a consumer?
I would consider myself more of a consumer. I do write short little poems every once in a while. I am particularly fond of the haiku.
Oh, okay.
and the way in which people take the format of the haiku and combine it with more contemporary themes.
Yeah.
And so I sometimes write little short haikus for myself. I keep one in my desk. But mostly I listen and I read. And
yeah. Well, very good. It's mentioning haikus. I have a Facebook friend, a brilliant classmate from college, who from time to time will write a haiku to describe mm-hmm. something that's just occurred in their life.
Yes.
And I will try to respond with a haiku of my own. I mean, commenting on what she's saying. And the first time we did that, I can't even think of the last decades had gone by since I'd written a haiku.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a fun thing to try to engage in.
Yeah.
Jean, tell us about the writing that you, I assume, are still doing as a poet. And, I mean, under what circumstances typically, what would prompt you to sit down and write a poem? And what is the experience of writing like for you?
My writing seems to come in surges, so I won't write for a period of time, and then something I read or someone I talk to or something will happen and I will write. It takes me a while to process something. I remember when I first started writing, I had gone through a divorce and blah, 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 and those things started coming down on paper. I've just been through a health challenge this past year, and I'm just starting to process that through writing. It takes a while for that to settle in and then for it to come out. And so I'm not a person who writes every single day. I'm not a person, you know, who has that discipline. Maybe I should, but I don't. So when the spirit moves, I will write. We have an event coming up at Spectrum Gallery, not directly related to the Poet Laureate program, but it's called Artery, where artists and poets work together. Oh. 1 year the artists respond to poems, and the next year the poets respond to art. And so those sorts of things. Oh, yeah, that's coming up. I need to get, you know, so that'll give me a push, those sorts of things. So
I like that.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what remains in this search process, which, if I understand correctly, you hope will culminate in the middle of October. So so where are we in this search right now?
Yeah, so right now we are accepting applications. And applications include, there is a form, we request a cover letter, and of course a sample of poetry. And those can be submitted online at our website, krpoets.com, or they can be submitted in print. There is a printable version on our website as well. Or if someone stops in at the library, we are happy to print one for you or help you get that. I know I've spoken with the Racine Public Library, and they are also willing to help with this as well. And print copies can also be dropped off at the library and sent to my attention. That's all in the print directions. They're due October 15th, and then we hope to have a month-ish, a month and a half to kind of go through everything and select our finalists and interviews, and then we hope to have our new laureates chosen before Christmas or early December.
And I'd like to say there are a lot of poets who, you know, they have a drawer full of poetry, but they haven't shared.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd like to encourage people to be brave.
Yeah. And I would say, too, we have had some really incredible applicants in the past who didn't ultimately end up getting the position. And we hope that they reapply, if anybody's listening, because they're... Just because you don't get it the first time doesn't mean you're not the right person to be a laureate. You know, it's sometimes it's an aligning of the stars.
Right. Yeah, as we were talking about earlier, sometimes there is, it might just feel like there is a particular need in the air. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, part of what's kind of interesting to think about is that sometimes the work of a poet can be, in a sense, sort of a jarring wake-up call, and might even be poetry that stirs up not only discussion but maybe even controversy. And of course, poetry can also be a very sort of soothing action that kind of brings people together and calms them down. And you know, I could imagine this going in a lot of different directions. And I suspect you really want poets out there to not be thinking this is not for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, you would be willing to entertain just about anybody with a gift.
Yes.
Yeah.
For sure.
When you say a sample of their poetry, what are you talking about? I mean, just a poem? Or
can we ask for how many pages? 10 pages?
Yeah, there is a, let's see, no more than 8 single-sided pages. So it just says a sample of your poems printed in 12-point font, no more than 8 single-sided.
So for one person,
pages.
That might be a poem. For
you're
another
right.
person, it might be 8 poems.
Sure.
Yeah, or 16, you know?
Right.
You never know.
And I suppose if somebody submitted something that was intriguing to you, you have ample opportunity later in the process to see more of their work and get to know them more.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. So again, if people want more information or feel like they want to pursue this possibility, how do they connect?
So like I said, they can go to krpoets.com. There is a comment form there as well that sends an email directly to me if they have additional questions. And all of the information about applications is there, information about our program, about past laureates is there. And then we do also have a Facebook page if you search for Kenosha Racine Poet Laureate Program.
Excellent. Jean Preston and Jennifer Kozaloo, thank you for being here to share the information about the Kenosha Racine Poet Laureate Program. And we hope that you will have all kinds of worthy applicants to sift through. We hope your decision is a difficult one, because we hope you'll have a lot of intriguing and compelling poetry to take in and explore. And thank you again for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out today's program, we're going to be remembering the events of September 11th, 2001, and the experience in particular of a woman by the name of Janelle Guzman McMillan, who on 9/11 was a 30-year-old employee of the Port Authority working in one of the towers of the World Trade Center. Janelle Guzman McMillan enjoys a special, indeed unique, distinction. She was the very last person to be pulled out of the rubble of Ground Zero alive, buried alive for 27 hours. She tells the story of that day in a remarkable memoir called Angel in the Rubble, The Miraculous Rescue of 9/11's Last Survivor, published by Howard Books. At one point in the book, Janelle Guzman McMillan writes, "Every time I hear those words, last survivor, they are a stark reminder that no one after me was found alive." Janelle Guzman McMillan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you, Greg. Good morning.
I wonder if you can tell us what it feels like for you to approach this 10th anniversary. For all of us, I think this is a powerful, poignant kind of experience, even if we didn't experience anything like you did on 9/11. Tell us what this feels like to be approaching this landmark anniversary.
Well, first of all, I can't believe that it's actually been 10 years. And, it has a lot of emotions, good and bad, at both sides. But personally, 9/11 means to me, it's just a beginning of a new life for me as well. It's a sort of healing process during the time that passes, and it kind of helped me to deal with the acceptance of, what I've been through, and I know, I'm sure it's a closure for the family as well in some point as time goes on, for them to accept that, it happened, we lost loved ones, and I hope the pain could be even more less as we, as we go about our life daily. So it's just like a healing process with time, and I just hope that, it gets better for most people as well.
You describe the morning of 9/11 as a day in which you had nothing in the world to be unhappy about. Life was good, really good. And you eventually made your way to the World Trade Center, where you worked for the Port Authority. Remind us of which tower you were working in.
I was working in the one World Trade Center. That's the first building that got hit. I was on there on the 64th floor of the World Trade Center.
Right. And you spend nearly a full page describing nothing but that moment of impact when the plane struck the tower. And for all I've read of the events on 9/11, I don't think anyone has more vividly depicted what that impact felt like and the different sorts of sensations which it created. It must have mildly reminded you of some of the earthquakes you'd experienced back in Trinidad and Tobago, but, of course, far more serious.
Yeah, I tried to put everything on paper in detail as much as I can remember those moments, minutes, bit by bit. And, being there on the 64th floor, you felt that big shake. You heard the loud bang, a distant bang, and, you wonder, what's going on? So I had no idea at that point what was going on. All I saw in my mind.
Right. You describe it as a sequence of events. This shattering noise, this terrible rumbling, a final sway of the entire building, and all of that lasting about 15 or 20 seconds. And of course, that was just the start of your ordeal. One of the things that was especially bewildering was
that you were, as so many people were, reassured that things would be okay and that you should stay put. At what point did you and some of your coworkers decide that you were not going to stay put in your offices, that you would try to exit the building?
That was actually after over an hour being in the building. That's when we saw the reporting on television saying that it could be a possibly terrorist attack. And by making a couple phone calls, family, friends, that's what they were saying also, that the plane had hit the building. So at that point, we were all so scared. We just didn't know what to do anymore. We've been up there almost over an hour. And at that point, we said, thank God to one of my colleagues. He decided, we got to try and get out. No one is coming. We got to take the staircase. And that's when we decided to take the staircase.
And you tell us that someone else in the office spoke up and said, no, we should stay put. But he was quickly outvoted by everyone else. You tell us that at one point, I think it was either over the television or over your computers, but you were, I think it was over the television, you were watching images from local news. Images of the towers, and you tell us you actually looked at the screen and tried to sort of count that image on the screen, tried to count the floors of the Trade Center to calculate where you were in relationship to the actual impact, although I don't think you were really successful in being able to do that.
Looking at it on television, you've seen the smoke. That's what we see, the smoke coming out of the building. And I was wondering, is that the actual building we in, or is it the next building that just got hit? And, but it was so devastating to look at, and someone just took the TV off and said, that's it, don't look at this, let's just go. And that's, that's why. But we had to leave, and it was, it was too long.
Just before you left, you receive an extraordinary phone call from someone named Lauren. Explain to our listeners what made this phone call so extraordinary.
Because Lauren is my cousin, and when I knew exactly what was going on, that our building was on fire, and I called Lauren up, and I was trying to get her attention on the telephone. She answered the phone. She has the phone in her hand, but she's just, looking at something and not responding to me. And she was like, oh my God, look what's going on. I can't believe what I'm seeing. And she was just going on, and I'm trying to get her attention. And she said, yes, Janelle, do you see what's going on? Do you see what's happening to the World Trade Center? I had to say, Lauren, that's what I'm telling you. I'm in that building. And she screamed out, and that just, my heart just sunk. And I told them I love them, and I'm getting out. And
so they knew you worked for the Port Authority. They had no idea. Nobody in your family knew that you actually worked in the World Trade Center, and that when they were seeing this image on the TV screen, that you were in that building. So you do make the decision, you and many of your coworkers, that you are going to leave. Again, you started out on the 64th floor. And one of the things that was extraordinary is that you almost made it. By your estimation, you reached at least the 15th floor. So you had made a great deal of progress. And then, of course, as I think people understand by now, you were caught in this terrible collapse. Did you know what had happened? I mean, did you have a sense that the entire tower had collapsed?
Yes, I knew exactly what was happening, but in my mind, I'd say, okay, you want to in denial that this has to be a dream, because this didn't happen. This is not happening. So, but I felt the rumbling. It happened so fast, knocked me to the ground. The dust, the darkness, that song, that humongous song that's coming on rumbling. I knew it. I knew what was happening, but I was in denial that this has to be a bad dream. I'm going to wake up out of this bad dream. But when I was hit to the ground and I tried to get up, that's when I realized that it's not a dream. It actually happened.
And you described that physical sensation of being in a sealed coffin. I mean, you were pinned in the rubble, and in no way were you able to extricate yourself at all, nor could you see a thing. It was absolute blackness, absolute darkness. And there you lay for 23 hours. Tell our listeners how you spent those 23 hours, the kind of journey which you ended up taking mentally and spiritually.
Well, I spent that hour surely just pinned under the rubble, nowhere to go, can't go to the clubs, right? So I just stood there in that moment, and it was my whole life reflection, being trapped under there, can't move my body, kept my head stuck between the concrete pillar. It's nothing else to do but just think about my life. And I was thinking about my whole lifestyle, my daughter, she was just 12 at that time. And I knew that Roger was outside waiting for me to get out.
This is your boyfriend.
Boyfriend, yeah, at that point in time. And, you know, everything just come before me. My mom, how I grew up, what my mom taught me. And, you know, I realized that I'm still alive under there. I'm closing my eyes every time thinking that I'm going to pass out, I'm going to die. You know, there's no way. But I realize every time I open my eyes, I'm still alive. And that's when I realized I want to live. I wanted to see my daughter. I want to come out. Mm. And that's why I just started to just beg and ask for a second chance. I asked God to get me out, save me, you know, send somebody, show me a sign. And I just started to talk with him and just beg and plead and bargain, make promises. Mm. And I felt it in my heart that I wanted to change my life. And that's when I was begging God to if he gives me the second chance, I would change my lifestyle. Because I was just crazy all over the place, a young girl growing up. And I knew I was taught to live a better life. I just rejected that part of my life.
23 hours you are in the rubble before a search dog finds you. And it is another 4 hours before you can be removed. That is how slowly and carefully and meticulously they had to work to remove you from the rubble. But you write, that overly cautious approach was perfectly acceptable to me. And so it is 27 hours from the moment of collapse to that moment when you are brought out of the rubble, the last living survivor to be removed successfully from the rubble of Ground Zero. You were hospitalized for 48 days after that with your very serious injuries, but seemed to have emerged from all of this with very little mental or emotional trauma. You say that by and large, you have no nightmares whatsoever. And one of the things you say is that God was your psychiatrist, and that's at least one reason why you have emerged as unscathed as you have.
Yes, you know, it's just so amazing to me that I actually survived that. You know, I looked at it unfold on television, and to see that, I never thought anyone could survive that. And, you know, me being there, despite from my crushed leg injury that I suffer, it's just so remarkable to not suffer any more head injuries, my head stuck. It's, you know, it's unbelievable. It's still not clear enough of why, you know, how did I do it? But I know it wasn't within my strength. I tried. I tried to get up. I tried to pull myself loose. I tried everything. The strength was not there. So there's only one logical explanation to this, that God had his hands on me that day, and I had to be here. And, you know, I'm here today.
And I know you feel very thankful. You begin one chapter by saying, if I were to count my blessings each day, the counting would never end. And I do appreciate that your book not only is your own story of gratitude, but also the sorrow and concern you feel for those who of course, were not so fortunate as you. All of that we see tied together so beautifully in your book, Angel in the Rubble, The Miraculous Rescue of 9/11's Last Survivor, published by Howard Books. Janelle Guzman McMillan, I so appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. Thank you very, very much. Best wishes.
Thank you for having me. God bless.
The time is 8:59, and tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be talking about the Heidi Observatory at Hawthorne Hollow for Kaylin Palomares' monthly visit to the program. And Dr. William Parker, I believe that's his name, I'm thinking about that off the top of my head, a physics professor at UW Parkside and also the director of the Heidi Observatory, will be with us as we talk about it and also about the problem of light pollution in our community. Sunny skies today. We're headed for a hot, high temperature of 86 degrees. Overnight, under partly cloudy skies, a low of 58. Tomorrow, sunny skies and a high of 85. Temperatures will gradually moderate as we approach the weekend. A high on Friday of 80, 78 on Saturday, with a chance of rain in our forecast for Sunday and Monday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.